The following program is being brought to you on the Seventh Wave Network. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit SeventhWaveNetwork.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Freud used to say the unconscious is like the ocean. Jung said inside of each of us is a self we do not know. When you bring your story, Sarah Mare brings the psychology. You bring your problems, Sarah Mare brings the meditation. You bring introspection, Sarah Mare brings the questions. Welcome to Talk with Sarah Mare. Your life is the inspiration in these unique, entertaining conversations with psychoanalyst Sarah Mare talking about romance, aspirations, even the news, and how psychology and meditation can enrich living. When you bring your life, Sarah Mare brings the psychology. Now, here is Talk with Sarah Mare.
Hello there. This is Sarah Mare, your host of Talk with Sarah Mare on Voice America, Seventh Wave Network. This hour is Real People, dedicated to sharing real stories, and I'm your host and psychoanalyst, Ms. Sarah Mare, live from New York City. First, I just want to thank you for being here. I know you could have been anywhere in the world right now, and you're choosing to be right here with me, and I appreciate that. And I want to be here with you. So today, I am very excited. We have a very special and talented person with us today named Richard Stanley. He is a global director who had a very fascinating career that started early, I think around his early 30s, we'll find out directly from him in a minute, where he created some amazing film work that got him recognized in Hollywood. And as his career progressed from his first film to his second film to his third film, he decided to make a very courageous move and exit the Hollywood scene to become a more remote creative person and develop documentaries that were of his own devotion and wish to share with others rather than following the material gains of the Hollywood industry. So I'm really excited to have him here today to discuss the choices that he's made and the developments in his career. So let's say hi to Richard Stanley. Hi, Richard.
Well, hey, it's a pleasure being with you.
It's a pleasure to have you here today. Mm-hmm. Can you hear me okay? What's that?
Yeah, no, it's the middle of the night here. I'm actually talking to you from the mountains of southern France, from the Pyrenees, where we've been in the middle of an Arctic storm for the last 2-3 days. I live in a place called Montségur, which is a former medieval castle, a citadel in the French Pyrenees, close to the Spanish border. So it's about 1 in the morning here.
Well, thank you so much for staying up all night or waking up super early to get on the telephone with me. I'm happy to be talking with you right now. I'm quite honored. Thank you.
That's a total pleasure. There's a log burning on the hearth. The place is extremely warm, and it's most excellent to be on air with you.
Oh, good. So, Montségur in France, tell us, that's in the southern Pyrenees?
It is. It's about 3 hours from Barcelona. It's just before you get to Spain.
And where were you living before you went to Montségur?
Well, I lived in London and Los Angeles. Before getting out, I lived in the middle of the city. I've always had a habit of being extremely urban, so in London I was living in Soho and in Portobello Road. I lived in L.A. for a couple of years as well. So, it was a big change transitioning from the 21st century to what's essentially a quasi-medieval lifestyle.
How long have you been living in Montségur?
Close to 10 years now.
Wow.
And, I don't regret the move in the slightest. In fact, every time I go into the outside world, I'm always keen to get back to the mountain as soon as possible.
So tell us, I mean, this, it's, I have to say, it's a lot of people's kind of big dream to just feel the courage to exit society and just go somewhere very remote and kind of unplug from their, you know, addiction to their cell phone and their need to know what's going on next. What do they call it? FOMO, fear of missing out, you know? You are a pioneer and I think somebody that a lot of people would like to emulate. What gave you the drive to make such a major move in the last 10 years?
Well, I've become more and more involved in the castle of Montsegur and its history over the years. I had first come across it while working on a documentary project. I did a documentary on the a wing of the SS, of Himmler's Schutzstaffel. Himmler financed a lot of archaeologists in the 1930s through something called the Ahnenerbe, the folk legacy department of the SS. And back in the 90s, I was engaged initially by Channel 4 Television's religion department to research the Ahnenerbe SS. And this entailed reaching out to basically every survivor of the department and going through a lot of Nazi archaeological records that had been left pretty much to lie since the war. And in the course of that, I started reading about the history of Montsegur in the area. And it put the hook in me, and I came down here to check it out for myself.
And what is the Ahnenerbe SS?
The Ahnenerbe SS was a sort of civilian division of Heinrich Himmler's SS, really the worst of the Nazis. But within that, Himmler channeled a huge amount of money into Gonzo's scientific research and archaeological work. All of which was largely left to lie because tainted by Nazism. It was kind of overlooked by conventional historians and scholars for a really long time.
Right.
So it presented kind of a treasure trove of hitherto untranslated and unknown material. Plus, since the advent of Raiders of the Lost Ark, there's so much bullshit that people believe about the Nazi occult that I was very keen to find out the truth.
And that was an assignment through Channel 4, did you say?
Yeah, initially it was a paid gig. I was insanely actually paid to go to Europe and research the story. So
What did they want to find out about it and why?
They wanted to do a sort of real-life follow-up to the Indiana Jones story.
I see. You said
they initially
wanted
to know if the Nazis had really been looking for the Ark of the Covenant.
Mm-hmm.
And in the course of it, I found that no, they hadn't been looking for the Ark of the Covenant, but they had been looking for the Holy Grail. And I went herring after the Holy Grail story, and Montsegur was identified as the Grail Castle by one of the guys working for the Ahnenerbe, Otto Rahn. Mm-hmm. Who came here in the 1930s.
I see. So he was in Montsegur for a period of time, and that's what led you there.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. And I translated a lot of Otto's material. And then when I brought it back to the UK and presented it to the other Reich historians, they saw it as evidence of how deeply insane and dysfunctional the Nazis really were. But I was keen to check. I didn't want to dismiss it as just complete madness. I needed to go and see for myself just to make certain whether it was true or not. And then, of course, I found that Otto was indeed telling the truth. And the place is absolutely fascinating.
Wow. And did you create a documentary around the life of Otto Rahn as well?
Yeah, I did in the end. I eventually made a feature-length film called The Secret Glory, which mm-hmm. is the true story of SS Obersturmführer Otto Wilhelm Rahn's quest for the Holy Grail. There are many things that fascinated me about Rahn. He was gay, and his mother was Jewish, both of which really conflicted him as an SS officer. So even mm-hmm. that alone, the notion of an SS man with a Jewish mother and who's too terrified to come out of the closet, would have already made for a good story, but the fact that he was paid by Himmler to try and find the Holy Grail really propelled it into something where I thought the story needs to be told.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, I was hoping to track down Otto, because a lot of people thought he'd changed his name and survived the war. And unfortunately, we pretty much conclusively proved he was killed in 1939.
And this film, yeah. The Secret Glory, was something that you put out into the world in 2001?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Most of it was done back in the 90s. I had to do it at that time because it was the last possible point when anyone in a command position in the Third Reich was still alive. They were basically already in there. Everyone who could interview was in their 80s at that point. And if we'd left any longer, we would have lost all of them, I think. Pretty much all of the folks, the 25 different interviewees in the documentary, are gone now.
Understood. So it was right around 2001 that your eyes opened up to Monsegur and the Holy Grail and wanting to spend a lot more time developing an understanding of what was going on in that land and with the people there.
Yeah, a bit of suppressed history, something that had been deliberately kept from public attention. I mean, partially because for seven centuries it was censored by the Inquisition. The Holy Roman Church and the Inquisition were so keen to make certain that nobody knew about it that they literally obliterated all record of it. They not only destroyed the books and the records, they destroyed the language they were written in. This place was originally a country called Occitania, where they spoke Occitan. But for centuries they made Occitan illegal. They made it a criminal offense to basically fuck anyone who didn't speak French.
Wow.
And, to deliberately bred them out of existence just so that no trace of it would remain. Then the story was largely rediscovered by Otto Rahn in the 1930s. But unfortunately, Otto was a Nazi. And with Otto's death and the fall of the Third Reich, the story was almost lost again. Mm-hmm. So, by the 80s and 90s, I felt there was a real need to translate the material and to try to disseminate it.
Wow. You seem like somebody, and I can completely relate to this, but somebody who, when you become interested in something, you develop a very deep passion for it, and you throw all of yourself at it and just live that interest until you move on to something else. Would you agree that you're like that?
Yeah, I think there's no other way to go if you're making movies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess I'm kind of a method director that way around, but ultimately, if you're not feeling an emotion or you're not connecting with it, you can't expect the audience to feel it either.
That's true. I mean, and it was 1990, only 11 years before you released The Secret Glory, that you made Hardware, your first film. So that's you really hit that hard. You did Hardware in 1990, then you did Dust Devil in 1992, and then The Island of Dr. Moreau in 1995. And then you're, from what I understand, done with Hollywood. Can you talk about that phase of your life?
Yeah, well, it was pretty, cataclysmic, a little like being on a roller coaster or a ricocheting bullet.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd worked on a lot of music videos, and I'd gotten so tired of making music videos in the 80s that I'd actually already at that point dropped out. In 1989, I took off and went to Afghanistan and headed for the Hindu Kush. But a script I'd written before I'd taken off, the screenplay for Hardware, went floating around from hand to hand in my absence. And found its way to Harvey and Bob Weinstein at Miramax. Managed to get set up. The first I heard about it, I was in a Saudi Red Crescent hospital in just over on the Pakistan side of the border after a major military action at Jalalabad. And a lot of people were dead and wounded. Someone from London managed to get through to me on the telephone at the Saudi Red Crescent hospital to try and tell me that they had somehow set up my movie and they were making a film from the screenplay I'd written.
Oh, my goodness.
Which I didn't believe at first. I thought they were mad or pulling my leg, and they were using so many F-words when they spoke to me. Their language was so bad.
Oh, my goodness.
It had been so hard for them to get through to me on the line in the hospital. It was all like, you have no idea how fucking hard we've been trying to fucking reach you, mate. I was kind of offended and thought they were crazy, and my initial response was to hang up on them. But yet it was true. They eventually got me back, and I went straight from Afghanistan into directing my first feature.
How old were you at that time?
I was in my early 20s.
Your early 20s, okay.
Yeah, I would have been about, I think, 23.
Wow, so young. And you were born in the late 60s in South Africa, is that what
you're
talking
about? That's right, yeah. I'm originally born in, just south of Cape Town in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And, I fell foul of the South African government when I was a teenager, mostly for being a liberal and for being opposed to apartheid.
I see. So, and your mother was a documentarian
as well? My mother
was
kind of a self-trained anthropologist.
An anthropologist.
Yeah, I mean, she was essentially an artist who'd come out of England, out of the West Country, and was fascinated with folklore and mythology. But when she got to Africa, she channeled that into writing and illustrating books with titles like Ancient Ruins and Vanished Civilizations of Southern Africa, Myths and Legends of Southern Africa, etc. So she really did a lot of good work documenting, lost history, African history. People don't know a lot about African standing stones or African ruins and African creation myths because they were largely ignored by white academia.
So it's interesting because you were raised with the perspective that, you know, finding out the history of the land and of the sculpture, the statues, the rituals was pinnacle, was very important and would take precedence over everything else. I mean, obviously your mother lived that as her whole way of being and raised you that way. So it's interesting that you have returned to that at this point in your life and made that your pursuit.
Yeah, I guess I blame her for gifting me or inflicting on me a rather non-commercial set of values.
Yes, right.
See, from the early days, she was carrying off to remote mountains and finding obscure piles of rocks and pointing at them with excitement as if they were somehow important. But I guess that rubbed off on me.
That's it, and it sounds like what you said is all in the face of her distaste and discontentment with academia, and it seems like in your life, from what I'm gathering, is that you had some kind of a discontent feeling from your experience in Hollywood, which wasn't able to capture your attention, which is very interesting because most people, if they have an opportunity to be a part of Hollywood, will do whatever they can to stay. I mean, practically, you know, just become whoever they have to be, say whatever they have to say, buy whatever they have to buy, and basically experience a loss of self in the process of gaining some kind of a reputation and persona that people buy into.
I'd be dead by now if I'd stayed in Hollywood.
Yeah, so what was it? What happened?
By now I'd have ended up floating in a swimming pool somewhere.
I gather that you're actually connected to something much, much deeper within your own being and your own sense of self, that you weren't able to live that with the just with the wish to be recognized and famed for something that you didn't really believe in. Is that what you were feeling?
I've always had a very hard time getting behind things that didn't connect with me. It's that thing of needing to have some emotional connection to the material. The further something goes away from what I believe in, and it ends up being often things which are antithetical to one's personal beliefs, it's very hard for me to just smile and go along with that and take the money, which has always been something that's gotten me into trouble. I mean, my mum also, I guess, inculcated in me from an early age a belief in the supernatural, not by intention, but because she was researching a book, Myths and Legends of Southern Africa, and was chasing down witch doctors and medicine men, and in order to accrue her data of African mythology and belief systems. So in my very early childhood, 1, 2, 3, 4 years old, I was growing up around extremely strange people. snake charmers, people who could put snakes in their mouths, which would then come out of their nostrils to scare the kids, or naked witches who could dance to old-fashioned, one lady I remember dancing to an old-fashioned Victorola gramophone player, which she balanced on her head so perfectly that she could dance to it and the needle never skipped. And these things seemed normal when you were a three-year-old or a four-year-old, or just funny. So I remember being witch entertained by the witch doctors and the strange people I was growing up around. It was only when I got to school that I started to realize that these things didn't exist in the so-called real world. And most folks thought that, yeah, witchcraft was something out of a fairy story or something which had no relevance to their lives. As a child, I imagined the world was full of spirits and invisible playmates, little furry men who lived in riverbeds who were invisible because they had magic pebbles they held in their mouths. And then when you turn around five or six and you get into school and meet other kids, you start to realize that the real world is different from all that.
Yeah. I imagine that you must have felt really alienated when you started school or were put into what you call the real world. Was there a time that you moved away from South Africa and that world and lived in a more urban environment?
Yeah, well, when I turned 16, I got drafted and I had the choice of either going into the South African army and fighting for the apartheid state or going to jail. And another thing that I guess my upbringing inadvertently did was it meant that I was never a racist. I was appalled by the Afrikaner kids and didn't consider myself to be a part of their system. I hated their language and I hated their leadership and I hated the police force and I hated their army. So, I guess I grew up as a liberal. At 16, I was basically forced to make a bunch of hard choices, and I ended up bailing out of the country and getting asylum in the United Kingdom in England.
So when you talk about
London when I was 16.
Wow. When you talk about needing to feel really connected to a story or to a project that you're involved with, what was it about Hardware, that your first film and the script that got picked up while you were in Afghanistan and that you flew back to create? What was it about that storyline that really compelled you to want to come back from Afghanistan and make that film?
Well, the first part of it, the first sequence, is based on a very direct dream I had when I was 13. But the whole of it is a nightmare about the near future. And being a bit of a technophobe, I've always been frightened I'd end up living in that world, which is an environmentally depleted, authoritarian police state, basically.
Right.
I read a lot of dystopian science fiction when I was growing up.
So when you talk about a police state or a mechanized environment, what do you see? How do you see that the world has actually become what you wrote about in Hardware at this point?
Well, that's the unfortunate part is we are tending more and more that way. That's partially because of the gradual collapse of the environment and the depletion of resources. As there's less and less to go around, so people are going to be meaner and meaner about making certain they get what they need. Mm-hmm. I mean, as with oil wars or water wars or anything else, I think that the gradual decline of the natural resources is naturally going to force human society further and further to the right. I mean, for a long period of time, we tried to kid ourselves that we have noble and good intentions. As in terms of foreign policy, but at the end of the day, if it comes down to not having oil or needing oil, people are going to want the oil.
Survival of the fittest is a very strong.
Yeah, which is naturally going to. We are going to reach a point where we're going to have to come out and say, yes, we are thieves and we're bad guys and we're proud of it. And to some extent, this gradual shifting from a liberal or left-wing society towards the right seems like some kind of frightening inevitability. What Philip K. Dick, the science fiction writer, refers to as the black iron prison of the future. Mm-hmm. The notion of this fully authoritarian total surveillance state, which we seem to be headed for, whether we like it or not.
You mean with all of the Google and the Apple devices and Snowden and all of the stories that have come about? Is that what you're talking
about? Recognition ID and things that scan your emails and Facebook mails so that they get an idea of your personality and what sort of things you like, and the ability to identify you, basically know everything about you.
And then use it to sell you things. It's really what they're doing to make sure either that you're not doing anything dangerous, so they say, and then also to try to market the right products your way. We are going to take a short break here at the end of this wonderful beginning to a conversation with Richard Stanley, the anthropologist and film director who was courageous in his career to depart from the success of Hollywood at the time when his career was actually thriving during the shooting of Island of Dr. Moreau, starring Val Kilmer and Marlon Brando. And he departed to create documentaries based on stories that he felt needed to be told and histories that he felt had been uncovered and needed to be shared with the people rather than the Hollywood stories that just sell big box office numbers. So we're going to continue speaking with the fascinating Richard Stanley when we come back from this short commercial break about what happened on the Island of Dr. Moreau and what projects he has coming up next and what it's like day to day living in the remote Montsegur, France, in the Southern Pyrenees without the iPhone, without the consistent access to the internet, without the grocery store around the corner that has whatever he needs, without Amazon delivering, without a lot of people around to distract him, and what that does for his creative life, how it behooves, how it may detract, and what his vision is for the next segment of his intensely passionate career and self-exploration. So you're with Sarah Mardé here on Talk with Sarah Mardé. I'm your host on VoiceAmerica.com, Seventh Wave Network with Richard Stanley, and we'll be right back in a few minutes. Thank you.
The Voice America Seventh Wave Channel. These days, everyone is looking for information on staying young, healthy, and fit. The Voice America Health and Wellness Network is here to help you on your quest to better health and a better you. We talk about everything from diet, fitness, and aging to substance abuse, personal growth, mental health, and much more. Learn from our experts who cover health and wellness from traditional and holistic perspectives. Tune in to the Voice America Health and Wellness Network. Healthy living starts here. Take us on the go. It's even easier now. The Voice America Talk Radio Network has launched our mobile app for iPhone, Android, or BlackBerry. Visit the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market to download the app powered by Aircast. It's free and no registration is necessary. In minutes, you could be enjoying your favorite Voice America Talk Radio host, no matter where you are. In the car, out and about, while traveling, or anytime you can't be close to your computer. Catch up on the archives you've missed or discover new shows on the spot. Search Voice America at your favorite app store.
This is the Voice America Seventh Wave Channel.
You are listening to Talk with Sarah Mardé. Call Sarah Mardé now at 1-866-472-5795. That's 1-866-472-5795. Or Skype at Talk with Sarah Mardé. Or email at talkwithsarahmardé@gmail.com. Now back to this week's program.
Welcome back. This is Sarah Mardé, your host of Talk with Sarah Mardé on Voice America, Seventh Wave Network. I'm here speaking with the celebrated filmmaker and anthropologist Richard Stanley, who happens to be in the remote Montsegur, France, the Southern Pyrenees. And let's bring him back online. Hey, Richard.
Hi, I'm still here.
Hi. So it's the middle of the night there for you over there in France.
It's probably around 1:30 in the morning, but it's just fine. Happy to talk.
So I'm interested, and I think the listeners will be interested to hear this, and I know you've been interviewed about this particular story several times, so you know, I'd like to also spend time talking about your experience in Montsegur and what it's like to live such an unplugged life. I think a lot of the listeners would like to hear about that. But if you could just kind of quickly fill us in on the details of your final experience in Hollywood and why you exited, and then we'll move over to really talking about your day-to-day life and your projects now. But just...
Well, what really happened was things escalated from hardware. Hardware was around 800 grand, just under 1 million. Before hardware, probably the biggest thing I'd shot would have been a music video for around 20,000. Music videos were made for 500 bucks or 700 bucks and were literally shot on Super 8 cameras and handheld 16 millimeter. When I jumped up to 20 grand, I suddenly got into the union. And had to have a union crew for the first time, honey wagon, makeup, catering, etc. Hardware, first feature, 800 grand. Then second feature, 1.5 million.
Dr.
Moreau went all the way to 75 million.
Oh my gosh, what a so, huge
yeah,
jump.
Yeah, so there was a rapid escalation over those period of years from working for on something with a budget of 500 bucks up to $75 million.
And that was really only between the year of like 1990 and 1995, and you were 26 to 31 about?
Yeah, so yeah, I had a meteoric ascent from nothing to extremely privileged in the course of, very few years. Made a series of correct choices, and ended up on the island of Dr. Moreau, which is probably the single worst most nightmarish location shoot of all time. I mean, it's way too long to explain all the terrible things that happened in the course of Moreau, because it's a pretty notorious case. There's an excellent feature-length movie about it called Lost Soul, directed by David Gregory, which tells the true story of the shoot of Island of Dr. Moreau.
It was called Soul?
Lost Soul,
Lost Soul. Okay, so if anybody wants to find out more, they can do that.
The feature-length documentary on what really happened on the island of Dr. Moreau, which was actually quite a lot. Very, very complicated thing. I mean, it obviously involved so many people and so many geniuses. But what really came down at the end of the day was that it was a corporate issue. I mean, ultimately, the shots were called by Time Warner, the parent company of New Line.
Right.
And I think if there's any single thing that was an issue, was there was simply no way that that movie would ever be made at that budget under the current corporate ecology. The situation that exists at the moment in Hollywood means that when you go over a certain budgetary level, it pretty much always has to be a... something like a family movie. Mm-hmm. And it pretty much has to conform to the structure and values that corporate Hollywood espouse. You can't expect them to give you $70 million or $75 million to just walk away and make the movie that you hoped you would make.
Did you become disillusioned then? You just kind of felt like your heart wasn't in it anymore and that you wanted to do something else? I mean,
Well, I actually cared about the material and couldn't actually turn around and do those things for the material. I loved the characters and the story and the whole thing that I'd been working on for so many years so much that I couldn't basically turn around and turn it into the Hollywood movie that they wanted to make it into. Moreau has particular problems. It's a complicated source material. It comes from a great novel by H.G. Wells. Was writing in the twilight of the British colonial period. There's various essential ideas in Dr. Moreau which are deeply offensive or kind of an anathema to the current cinematic ecology. A lot of the ideas are tricky.
What are some of the ideas that are difficult for people to digest?
Okay, well, that's a very basic thing. Dr. Moreau deals with turning animals into human beings. Dr. Moreau as a humanizing process that he's able to give animals the power of speech, like Dr. Doolittle, by giving them larynxes, the ability to articulate sound and to advance them to some extent, which fundamentally challenges the notion that human beings are particularly special. People
right.
like to believe that humans are some paradigm, that man alone is made in God's image, and that we are somehow more important than the creatures around us.
That we have a more developed brain with a greater consciousness, a greater ability to think critically, right? Which allows for...
Yeah, we like to think so.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Essentially, we define humanity by whether the other creatures are able to speak to us in our own language and tell us in our own language to stop killing them.
Mm-hmm.
As in, get your hands off me, you dirty damn ape. If something can't speak our language and behaves differently from us, we assume that it's unintelligent, and we also assume that we have the right to kill it. Gorillas and chimpanzees have something like 95% of our DNA. They're almost completely human, but can't speak, don't have larynxes. We can teach them sign language. We can teach them how to use keyboards, but that doesn't really count. We still don't really classify that. We still feel we can kill them and experiment on them. Different tribes, people like the Khoisan Bushmen, were virtually wiped out by the Afrikaners and were shot out like animals. The Tasmanian Aboriginal was completely exterminated. They killed every single one of them and wiped them out in Tasmania because they didn't think they were human. They didn't speak the same language. The Bushmen were native. They spoke in cliques and had no conception of property. And physiologically different from us, stored water in their breasts and buttocks. So they failed to identify them as being of the same fucking species that killed them with impunity at the beginning, until finally people said, no, hey, you shouldn't do that. And it was only literally in the last 50 years that we got around to giving them equal rights and bringing them into society. So that was one of the problems of Moreau, was I guess it questions the issue of humanity, the definition of it. Moreau thinks that the definition is really one of the stupidest things that mankind's ever done.
Mm-hmm. I can see why the story interested you in the first place and why you wanted to create a screenplay out of the book. I could see why that would be of personal interest to you, because it sounds aligned with the interests that you have in the development of a society, the spiritual component to a group of people, and how they continue surviving based on their ability to connect with the spirit rather than just material.
And what went wrong was that had the movie been made now, the situation might have been different, because we're in a post Planet of the Apes reboot environment, and we're in a post Guardians of the Galaxy environment, where people now understand that you can make movies with some kind of talking animal, or where the ape or the creature is one of the leads. But at that point in time, what they really wanted was they wanted a Val Kilmer movie with a bunch of monsters.
I see.
Really perceived my beast people as being monsters to begin with. I always thought they were the lead characters. It would be a bit like if you were making Planet of the Apes and they suddenly decided, actually, this is a Gary Oldman movie, and these other characters, Caesar and these ape characters, they can we should not have them speak and just have them come in a couple of scenes, and Gary Oldman should kill them all with a big gun. The movie they wanted was fundamentally different from the film I wanted to make going in, which led to obviously intractable problems. They couldn't get rid of me at first, because Marlon Brando only agreed to do the movie if I directed it. Knowing that they needed Marlon to hold down the budget meant they couldn't get rid of me off the project immediately. They kept trying. And it was only, unfortunately, when Brando ran into trouble, when first of all, there was the murder in Mulholland Drive, and then Cheyenne, Brando's daughter, committed suicide, which caused the big man to basically totally spin out and drop out of the movie he'd been in at the time, which was a film called Divine Rapture in Ireland, which collapsed as a result. But right. then when they couldn't, yeah, count on Brando arriving, suddenly they didn't need me anymore to ensure that Brando got there, and the entire thing kind of exploded.
I see. So interestingly, your departure from Hollywood is rather parallel to Brando's departure when he went to the remote island to spend the rest of his days, really, and fought for causes that he really believed in for Native Americans.
Yeah, Tetiaroa. It's complicated. The whole story is super complicated. I mean, Tetiaroa was Brando's atoll. And just across the goddamn water, of course, is in Tahiti, was Mururoa Atoll. Mururoa is almost like Moreau, but slightly different spelling. But Mururoa Atoll is where the French started letting off A-bombs, resumed A-bomb testing. Which the Tahitians were demonstrating against. When the murder happened in Mulholland Drive, the DAG, the guy that Christian Brando's son shot, killed, was the son of the main Tahitian pro-independence protest leader against the French nuclear testing in Moreau Atoll. There was this incestuous connection between Moreau and the events going on in real life, which... made it a complex and difficult experience. And a number of different factors went into it, but there was simply no way that I was ever going to be able to shoot the movie that I set out to shoot. We also had a hurricane and a bunch of other issues along the way.
Yeah. So in your recent 10-year experience, this last decade of your dedication to Montsegur and the land and the history there, starting with your interest in Otto Rahn and the Holy Grail, do you experience periods of loneliness, or what is it like to be so detached from such a highly intense Hollywood experience and at this point be living close to the land and you know, making fires and finding food?
One part of it is similar to what it would be if you're going on a long-distance yacht journey, or if you were maybe going to Mars. In that, there's a sense of being extremely isolated and away from the world. And I think that unless you're comfortable with being alone, it would be impossible for people to do this.
Yeah.
But I don't feel I need the validation of other human beings to feel I've had a good day anymore.
Right.
And, keep myself fairly organized here in the mountains. So that way around, I guess, I'm able to survive it. I think...
Was there a period of time that you said you don't need the validation from people anymore? Was there a period of time when you were there that you had to work through a lot of those feelings? Was there a period of like anxiety or a fear of disappearing because nobody was really seeing you? Or how did you reach the next level of detachment?
I had a sort of fall on the road to Damascus moment about 10 years ago, where the scale suddenly fell from my eyes. I went, "Oh my fuck! What am I doing? Wasting my life in London? I need to be here."
It just
happened. It was also really the point when I dropped the other shoe and stopped being an atheist.
I see. And what happened then? When you stopped being an atheist, did you start believing in something, or what was it?
Yeah, I became a believer. I'm not sure what end, but I started to accept that there was a force higher in the world, more powerful than me. There were indeed invisible powers. I wouldn't want to define those powers too carefully, but... It was a definite point, and it was Montsegur that did it, that pushed me over the edge into finally accepting that there was things about my life that I had no conception of. It seemed more important to me than anything that was going on back in the city to try and understand that.
Do you feel that there are aspects of yourself that don't get explored due to the diminishment or the lessening of human interaction? Do you feel like there are parts of you that you know, that might be more inspired if you were around people more often? Or do you feel like there's more of you to access because you're not distracted by human interaction?
It's still pretty distracting out here. And yeah, the unfortunate part is being essentially being a storyteller or a showman by nature, not having anyone to tell stories or to
actually show
stuff to. I do miss that.
Yeah, I mean, part of being an artist or a creative person is showing it or sharing it with others, right?
Yeah, I go up and read to the ghost in the castle.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, and unfortunately, living in France or Occitania, it's also there's a language barrier issue where you can communicate, but at the same time, much nuance and the sense of humor is lost.
Mm-hmm.
So people never
get
my goddamn jokes.
Mm-hmm. And humor is so important, isn't it? We all need to laugh.
Yeah, my best banter is wasted. I banter with the cat. The cat doesn't quite get it. I suspect the cat is secretly French. So, I do miss that part of it. I still have good banter, and but up here I don't get a chance to exercise it.
Well, so I'd like to kind of riff off of what you were talking about kind of being in touch with a greater source. I think that's a really important communication to a lot of people who feel that they are only connected to one another or to the material gains or to getting their goals met in order to feel valid. And I think that kind of learning to settle back in our bodies and open up to experiencing the life force within and that is connected to all living beings is a really important practice, no matter where we live and how urban our life is, how metropolitan we are. So I'd like you to stay on the line while I start to bring the listeners into a short guided meditation at the end of our talk today. Is that okay? Would you like to stay with us?
Yeah, awesome.
And I just wanted to also tell the listeners that, you know, you can find Richard Stanley, our guest today, on the internet. He does have a bit of a web presence. He is on Facebook. Richard, why don't you tell us a little bit about the Terra Umbra Facebook page that you have?
Yeah, and I run a site on the internet called Terra Umbra, TerraUmbra, which is literally shadow land, which is devoted to our local mysteries, to Montsegur, and to the notion that there may be parallel worlds existing side by side with our own.
Very good. And you can also find Richard Stanley's body of work written about on Wikipedia. He has a Wikipedia page dedicated to him, which I've added into this the promotional blurb about this particular episode. So if you go ahead and look on the voiceamerica.com page where my episodes are described, you'll find Richard Stanley's Wikipedia page. So let's settle down now into just starting to feel our breath in our body. Just slowing down, starting to tune in to the slow and steady opening of breath in our diaphragm, just below our rib cage. This is something that we can all do at any time during the day, just stop and begin to notice the way that our body opens, expands, and contracts as the breath just naturally leaves our body, creating internal stimulation through the movement of muscle and breath. And just noticing that as you tune into that experience, your breath will become deeper. You don't even have to tell yourself to breathe. You can simply allow yourself to feel the movement of breath in your body and allow your mind to become consumed with that experience, allowing you to settle more deeply into the present. And very simply begin to notice that your spine ends at the very center of your pelvic bones in your back. Notice that your spine, you can even put your hand on it, creates like a stem or a very strong foundation for your rest of your body to be held up by. Now try to imagine now that your spine is uncurling at the very base. It curls forward like a little tail, but it curves forward. Imagine that it's uncurling now and reaching down into the earth. If you're standing, just imagine that it's moving down between your legs. If you're sitting, just imagine that it's reaching down. Your spine is like a snake spiraling down and moving through the first layer of dirt and rock, maybe mud, depending where you are. And moving down, your spine is pushing down into the, perhaps it's roots of trees intertwined. And moving down through layers of rock. And imagine that your spine is now pushing down toward the core center of the earth, where the magma holds this entire structure together. We are sitting on a big rock that is centered by a hot molten lava called magma. And at the core center of this earth, this magma just sits and palpitates and, yeah, it just burns. And just imagine that your spine is connecting down into that molten lava. And then as you inhale, your spine is like a straw. So you're inhaling the heat from the core center of the earth and feeling that heat rising into your lower abdomen through your spine. And as you slowly exhale, feel the heat of the core center of the earth rising through your pelvis, then through your solar plexus, then into your heart, through your throat, and out the top of your head, out the crown of your head, and into the universe, connecting you to the galactic unknown, the energetic source. This is a very simple grounding meditation that will bring you to a sense of connectedness with the earth, with the powers beyond our even ability to understand. There's a mysterious force of nature that resides within us and around us, interconnects all of us with one another, spans race, spans time, and it spans species. It's all living beings, all living matter, all organic matter, past, present, future, has a vibrational charge. And this charge, this life force, is mysteriously somehow activated, ignited, and continues to pulse. There's the idea that energy never dies, it only transforms, and that's what we're doing here, is living organic matter with the ability to transmute energy through expression, through experience, through communication. And when we lose our minds and become completely connected to or attached to the idea that the outside world is going to save us because we're too afraid that we might die on some deep level, we're afraid of death or afraid of being left alone, we become very, very fear-based and attached to the outside, we can start to bring ourselves back to this internal experience and our breath, our connection to the earth, our connection to the galactic planes out there, our connection to the spirits and everybody, every living being, and start to listen to our own internal voice, our truth, our sense of truth, and start to speak from that place and live with our convictions rather than living with the need to be validated or the need to be a part of something that we think we're missing out on. That FOMO is a big word out there, fear of missing out. People are running around, they're detached from their own bodies to try to make the grade. So let's thank Richard Stanley, our very special filmmaker and anthropologist who's joined us today on Talk with Sarah Mate to talk about his experience leaving the big scene of Hollywood to dedicate himself to documentarian work and living in Montségur, France. You're welcome to find him on the internet, Richard Stanley, filmmaker. And I hope that you join us here next week on Talk with Sarah Mate. This is Sarah Mate. You can email me at any time during the week if you have any questions or you want to be featured on the show. I hope that you join us again every Thursday, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 4 p.m. Pacific. Thank you so much, and I wish you a blessed week.
Thank you for tuning in to Talk with Sarah Mare. We can't wait to hear more from you and share more with you on next week's program. Please be here next Thursday at 4 p.m. Pacific Time and 7 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America 7th Wave channel. Have an enlightening week.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Seventh Wave Network. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit SeventhWaveNetwork.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit VoiceAmerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.